You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, November 2nd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, oh, folks, you know how happy I am about this. Chris Hayes of Up With Chris every weekend on MSNBC. Don't miss it. Must see TV on the weekends. Also today, General Strike in Oakland. Herman Cain. Evidence point number 473. This guy's a huge joke. We'll get to that. In the better half of the program, I will break down the video that one of the videos that that guy Stranahan did for Andrew Breitbart's site. Also, Bloomberg continues to lie about the role of our government in the financial crisis. Right-wing terrorists, they were going to spread ricin by shelling beans. I'm not sure. We got to look into that. Based on a book written by a Fox contributor. Surprise, surprise. Greek bailout hits a snag. Turns out people don't want to be screwed. President Obama takes hold of the XL, Keystone Pipeline, all this and more. But today, ladies and gentlemen, in Oakland, there is a general strike planned. We don't know. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to go, but I can tell you this. There's a picture in a Gentleman's Warehouse clothing store saying we will be closed on Wednesday for the general strike. I love it. I think the last suit that I ever purchased myself, which was literally 8 years ago, was at a Gentleman's Warehouse. And I loved that suit. I lost the sport coat somewhere. I don't know where I lost it. But generally, the clothing I wear, I've accumulated over the years, back when I used to have a little bit more of a fancy lifestyle. I have, if anybody sees me on TV, you know I have basically two sport coats. And they almost look identical. And then I have three shirts I got for Christmas last year from Nikki's dad that I rotate through. And a couple of ties. And the best stuff I had actually took from, like, a TV show that I did. And they let me keep it. I was on Kudlow last night talking about Herman Cain. We'll talk about that later in the program. Harvard students plan to walk out of Greg Mankiw's economics class to show solidarity with a general strike in Oakland. We know yesterday, as reported on this program, the longshoremen up and down the West Coast plan to join in with a strike. And the police from Oakland issued a statement. We represent the 645 police officers who work hard every day to protect the citizens of Oakland. We, too, are the 99% fighting for better working conditions, fair treatment, and the ability to provide a living for our children and families. We're severely understaffed, with many city beats remaining unprotected by police during the day and evening hours.
As your police officers, we are confused. On Tuesday, October 25th, we were ordered by Mayor Kwan to clear out the encampments at Frank Ogawa Plaza and to keep the protesters out of the plaza. This is what this whole statement's about. They wanted a reason to be able to come out and say, hey, we were ordered to do this, contrary to what the mayor has said. Then on Wednesday, October 26th, the mayor allowed the protesters back in to camp out at the very place they were evacuated from the day before. Well, in fact, they were protesting. To add to the confusion, the administration issued a memo on Friday, October 28th, to all city workers in support of the stop work strike scheduled for Wednesday, giving all employees, except for police officers, permission to take the day off. I think schools in Oakland are closed, too. Is that correct?
I'm not sure.
Well, so it remains to be seen. Hopefully this thing is big. But if you're in the Oakland area, no work, no school, general
strike.
Yes,
that's correct, yeah.
Do it. And maybe in the later half of the program, you can call in and tell us what you're seeing on the ground, because the strike theoretically won't start till noon. I mean, that's when people usually show up for work, and it would be interesting to see what gets shut down in Oakland. Hopefully it's a lot. I have said multiple times on this program that a general strike, withholding labor, withholding your participation in the daily aspects of society, is your strongest weapon. This is just the beginning, folks. Just the beginning. When we come back, we'll be talking to Chris Hayes. We are back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Majority Report. My name is Sam Cedar. On the phone, it is always a pleasure to welcome to the program Chris Hayes. And now I think this is the first time we've introduced you this way, of Up With Chris every morning, every morning on the weekend anyway, Saturdays and Sundays, 7 a.m. on Saturdays, 8 a.m. on Sundays, correct?
Yes, on MSNBC.
That's right. Okay. Didn't I say MSNBC?
I don't know.
All right,
but
well,
I got to make sure I get that.
No,
get that
of course. It's not on Fox.
Yes,
surprisingly
that's correct.
Enough.
If you start looking for us there, you will be gravely disappointed.
And now let me just get this out of the way, because if I didn't do this, I would get harassed by my listeners for being disingenuous. I love your show. It's fantastic. I knew it would be great, and it is great.
Thanks, Sam.
So,
thanks a lot.
I cannot recommend it enough to everyone. And I would say, watching it online is a great experience, but DVR it at the very least so that the advertisers know that people are watching.
Yeah, yeah, no, that would be great. And you were great when we had you on, and you were actually part of I think if not our best, definitely one of our best shows. So
that was
a really fun conversation with you and Bob Herbert and John McWhorter and Melissa Harris Perry on Martin Luther King. That was a great.
It was a fun show to do. I had three pastries. One in the green room and two during the course of the show. I got to ask you this. Are you disturbed at all by this breaking news that China is developing nuclear weapons?
It's truly terrifying. I mean, I think what we'll see is an absolute shift in the balance of power. You know, next thing you know, they'll have a Security Council vote. They might, You know, it may precipitate a need for some ping pong diplomacy.
Yes.
The mind reels at all the things that we're gonna have to do.
Let's just hope they don't start dipping into like capitalist type style reforms, because then I think we could be in trouble.
Exactly.
Herman Cain once again.
Well, I'm actually more. You know what? I'm worried. I've been more worried about. I had heard some early reports, and this is just, you know, this hasn't been made public yet, but I have sources that Uzbeki Stan is actually on the verge of also getting nuclear weapons.
There you go.
Which would really be
broken.
Terrifying.
Hold on for a second. All right, so let's. I'll be talking about Herman Cain later in the program, much to my chagrin, because it's sort of irrelevant, and maybe another day we can talk about the campaign, but we haven't had a chance to speak, at least on this program, since the Occupy Wall Street protests have began, and mm-hmm. I wanted to just get your sense of, at first, it's just sort of what you think about the movement in general.
I find it, you know, very encouraging and heartening and fascinating. I think it's fascinating for a number of reasons. I mean, the thing I think is most interesting about it, and what I have been most attuned to, is the way in which it has completely broken down this narrow box that we put political activity into, and has unleashed this torrent of imagination about what politics can look like as action, as performance, as things that you do in the streets. I think we had handed down to us a conception of what politics were that had sort of two tracks. There's electoral politics, and that means, you know, voting, registering voters, you know, calling people, knocking on doors, maybe sending emails, contacting your elected representatives. And then there was, you know, street action, which was marches. You know, they're going to have a war. We don't want the war. We're going to get into the streets in March. And the fact is, there's all kinds of different ways that politics can be pursued and communicated and expressed. And I think it's triggered this kind of bout of imagination. You're seeing it today in Oakland with the general strike, which I don't know if it's going to work. And my sense is that it's going to be nowhere near a total general strike in Oakland. But the notion of a general strike is just – it's like from an alternate universe when you look at where our politics are right now and how politics by citizens is pursued and performed. It's so radical and sort of exhilarating to sort of conceptualize things at the epic scale that I think that Occupy Wall Street has invited us to conceptualize things.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I've always been in the past – skeptical of any type of I guess they call it Dionysian sort of protest, which is the sort of that notion, and I don't even know if I've ever said that word out loud, frankly, but it's sort of the notion, the aspect of protest that are sort of semi-performance based, I guess, is a way of talking about it. I've always been somewhat skeptical of those in the context of a one-day protest. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of a guy walking with stilts, to protest the Iraq war, always I found unhelpful.
Yeah, I think it left me cold too, I would say.
But there's something about the idea of the occupation itself, which is so compelling that, and almost in some way is an ends, it's not quite an ends in and of itself, but it is the occupation itself, it is taking sort of the commons, and it is a very symbolic but also very real gesture. And then there should be some element of performance based in this, because that's what maintained that presence.
Right. And the other thing, I mean, aside from the performance aspect, there is what is really interesting, and I sort of wish in some ways I were a grad student at this point and I could, you know, do this as a full-time – well, I don't wish that. I have, like, the best job in the world. But it would be fun to –
Well, I wish I was at least in my 20s.
It would be very fun to be doing a kind of sustained study of the General Assembly, which is the kind of the sort of – people's legislative process, because what is unfolding down there in this communal attempt at modeling a form of self-governance that is accountable and responsive and direct and radically democratic is to model all the things that people feel our current government is not. And as they model it, as they move through its evolution, they encounter problems, problems of scale, problems of representation, problems of efficiency, and are in real time trying to work those out. And it's a fascinating, fascinating thing to behold, because I think it's produced, you know, it's reconnecting people with the sort of experience of citizenship that we are very alienated from because of all the ways in which, A, we outsource our duties as citizens, and that's understandable. People are extremely busy, and I'm, you know, I'm not a single mother with three kids and a you know, non-living wage job. And I myself have a hard time putting in the amount of...
That's the breaking news.
That I was about to say. Is that the breaking news, Sounder?
Yes.
Just so folks know that I'm not... So I think that part of it is also really interesting. You're seeing struggles to figure out how to do this. And I think that the core insight of Occupy Wall Street and this and the General Assembly is that the fundamental problem we face, the social problem, the specter that haunts us, is excessive verticality, is excessive social distance, excessive inequality, a wide and almost unbridgeable gap between the people on the top and the people at the bottom, the sort of corruption and corruption of hierarchy that has turned into oligarchy. And the way the General Assembly is structured, the way that their people in Occupy Wall Street are approaching their task is to put forward a radical repudiation of verticality with radical horizontality, right? With consensus decision making, in which no one is higher than anyone else. And anyone who's ever run an organization will tell you that's a very difficult thing to pull off.
Right.
Hierarchy is inherent often in organizational growth. So watching them work through this and watching them offer this continued rebuke to the core problem we have, I just find really fascinating and inspiring.
Yeah, and it really does put it into relief in some way. And, you know, your book is forthcoming, I guess, in January, February?
Actually, in the spring.
Which deals a lot with these issues. And,
yes.
And you know, one of the things that the only people out there who are expressing this, at least in the context of your platform, about the danger of this excessive verticality, the implications of having a plutocracy in this country,
yep,
and having such income disparity is not simply a question of fairness. It is also, there's some very practical implications to this,
yes,
to the long-term health of our society. Talk about that for a little bit. I mean,
yeah, this is the sort of core, you know, one of the core insights of the book that I'm sort of finishing up a second revision of and will be out in the spring is that we tend to think about inequality in how it affects the 99%, right? You know, the way that it pushes down wages, or the way that it produces a whole set of goods, housing, education, healthcare, chief among them, the prices for which are bid up, right, by the people who are in the 1%, and then make it more difficult. We get this sort of two-tiered system, right? And anyone who lives in New York sees this all the time up close,
right?
You used to, you know, neighborhoods or restaurants or all sorts of services that were once sort of accessible have now been kind of bid up and out of reach because of all the torrent of finance money, et cetera. So that's how we think about inequality. The core argument that I make in the book is that the other side of inequality's cost is that it makes the 1% worse. It actually structurally confines the 1%, makes them more blinkered, more self-dealing, more corrupt, less farsighted, less capable of doing the things that you want an elite to do. And I think that we've seen that, you know, the financial crisis is the most perfect example of that, in which the bonds, we created a financial mechanism that could yoke together the fates of a African-American grandmother in Charlottesville, Virginia, who's got a single family home and a second mortgage she took out with a predatory lender, to a Norwegian town that had bought part of her loan through their pension fund. And the middleman is Goldman Sachs in that transaction. And so the mechanism was there to link all that together, but there was not the mechanism to have to sort of have a representative picture of what all that would mean. And so what happens is the water starts pouring into the ship on the bottom in the slave decks, right? And in steerage, and the people on the top of the ship just have no idea. Even the good ones, right? I mean, that's the thing, is that the way inequality, the kind of inequality we have functions, is that it produces all sorts of incentives to corruption. But even the ones who aren't corrupt, you know, Ben Bernanke is a perfect example of someone who I think is not corrupt, right? I mean, he has gone about doing what he does in good faith, but he's made a lot of good faith errors. And part of that, I have to think that if Ben Bernanke, if the Ben Bernankes of the world, the Alan Greenspans of the world, the Bob Rubens of the world, the Peter Orszags of the world, the Tim Geithners of the world, lived in a neighborhood in which they saw people getting predatory loans and being foreclosed on, we would have had a very different response to the financial crisis.
You know, as you're talking about this sort of the distance from which the ruling elite have from what is actually happening in reality,
yep.
as defined by the experience of the vast, overwhelming majority of people.
Yep.
You know, the only thing I keep thinking back and over the years is that book by Jared Diamond, Collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, to a certain extent, that was one of his central theses,
yep.
he was talking about. Every society has, when they collapse, it is because the elite is in a gated community of
yep.
the mind, if you
yep.
will, and,
yep.
and that's the problem, isn't it?
You know, Plutarch, as far back as Plutarch. Plutarch wrote that the imbalance between rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailments for a republic, and. It's, I think, as true today as it was then. I mean, we have democracies have all kinds of representational problems when it comes to minorities, and that has been played out throughout our history, right? And you see this problem of excessive social distance in all sorts of places. You know, the one example I like to use is the AIDS crisis, right? There you had this real representational problem because you had this thing, this horrible Holocaust going on amongst a relatively small, numerically marginalized, hated minority, gay mm-hmm. men in San Francisco, New York, and other places.
One that's sequestered by social mores.
Exactly. And removed and distant in all these ways. And so what happened was it was largely ignored in the beginning. Of course, you know, it takes Reagan several years to mention AIDS in a speech. His press person jokes about it. You know, when asked the first time at a press gaggle, he says, "I don't have AIDS, do you?" Something like that. So there's – and what happens? What happens with AIDS? Well, guess what? It doesn't stay in the gay community.
Right.
It spreads, right? Hemophiliacs get it, and IV drug users, and then tons of straight men and women, primarily straight women, if you look at the numbers now. And so it's a perfect kind of metaphor for what happens if you when you have a problem that social distance bars our mechanisms of representation from dealing with, right? Now, in the case of AIDS, you're dealing with what you expect a sort of expected dysfunction in democracy, which is dealing with minorities, right? If you have majoritarian rule, you have to come up with all sorts of ways that you don't let the majority screw over, ignore minorities. But what we have now is an even more perverse situation, right?
Right.
In which majority problems, wage stagnation, unemployment, indebtedness are not being dealt with because of the social distance of a very small minority. And that's when you get to a point where you're dealing with something that's in a difference of kind and a more existential threat to the whole sort of representational system.
Now, you know, one of the problems, there's another issue, though, it seems to me, in terms of the plutocracy in this instance, is that not only are they sequestered from the rest of society, you know, it's like, you have a situation where the whole house is on fire, but they live in a small safe room and they're just completely unaware of it. And
this is geographically true, in the sense that I think it was Jamie Galbraith at UT Austin I saw him the other day saying that there's five counties that have if you took away those five counties, American inequality would essentially disappear.
Right. Right. And so they have no sense of what's going on. I think I told you that story of that a listener told me of Bob Rubin, who was driving, you know, to a place, and he was in a traffic jam, and he had actually called the mayor's office to complain. And when this listener who met him at a fundraising function said, "Where was the traffic jam?" In New York City, he didn't know.
Right.
He
right.
didn't know what where he was when he was in the right. traffic. He just knew that he was, but the other problem is that the opportunity to use this, you know, the house is on fire, but they're in a small sequestered room that they can't feel the heat. And theoretically, if someone looked out that window and said, "Oh my God, the entire structure of the house is about mm-hmm. to fall." The only other problem is that now we live in such a global sort of climate for these very wealthy people that they may not perceive it as that much of an issue for them.
Right.
Because, oh, we have this walking bridge to the next building, right, which happens right. to be in London, or it's right. in whatever it is, Dubai. It doesn't right. matter. How do we deal with that issue?
Oh, man. I don't know how you deal with that issue.
You only have a couple minutes.
I do think – I guess I will say this. I do think the attachment to place is least strong among the sort of Davos globalized, you know, uber rich. But it still exists. And right. one of the really interesting things we've seen actually at the state level is when taxes on the rich get passed, everyone warns that the rich are all going to leave the state. And this is what happened in Oregon. And they didn't. people are even – very wealthy people are pretty invested in where they are, you know?
Right.
And I think that there is – I do think, you know, that there's an argument to be made to those folks, particularly the sort of good faith among them. And I don't want to like too much otherize them. It's, you know, I work for a big cable news network. It's not like I'm so remote from the 1%. But that actually more equality is actually in their interest as well. In the long run, because I think it creates a healthier, more stable society, which, you know, if you're at the top, ultimately in the long run, that's what you want. And that was in some ways what FDR was able to,
right.
you know, over great consternation and wailing and whining and whinging and opposition was able to convince the kind of plutocrats of his era and it turned out to be true.
All right, so you know, I'm going to let you go. I know you're obviously busy setting up for your show this weekend. But lastly, I mean, just give me a sense of what potential scenarios you see playing out. I mean, Occupy Wall Street has already had such a dramatic effect on at least the narrative, and affected the rhetoric. I don't think it's had necessarily the implications that we would want it to, from a legislative perspective, mm-hmm. but at least in terms of narrative, things have changed. Mm-hmm. What do you think happens next? I mean, what could potentially happen with a movement like this?
You know, it's so unpredictable. I do think the general strike in Oakland plants an idea in people's head yeah. of action on the kind of scale that it would take to really, really shake up the sort of comfort of the sort of ruling class. And I think there's something profound in the potential of that. I also think, to be honest, I'm pretty terrified about the state of the global economy. I think we're not paying adequate attention here in the States to what's going on in Europe.
Right.
But it's very unclear to me. If I had to bet, I would bet there's going to be some other kind of large global financial crisis in the near future. And I think if and when that happens, then what's happened is planting the idea of this sort of imaginative, open, almost epic framework for the ways that you can react to it mean that the sky's the limit in terms of what kinds of change we might be able to get, you know, in one of those moments.
I think next spring, I think we're going to see potentially the largest general strike we've seen in this country in 70 years.
Yeah.
And obviously there haven't been many general strikes. I mean, the last one was in, I think, the 40s or.
It was in the 40s. And it should also be noted it's illegal. I mean, that's, you know. It's illegal for unions to participate in general strikes.
It's illegal for unions to officially call for one.
Yep.
I mean, but as
sympathy strikes of any kind, I mean, that was the first piece of that's, I think that's part of Taft-Hartley, right?
Right. Exactly. And
they,
so
was
you
one
cannot
of the first things they did, because it was, you know, what the auto workers were able to do was to bring down, you know, you could take out an entire industry.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think the in some ways, because of two things, of one, of social media, and two, I think unions are sort of, you know, trying to fold in some of what they're doing with this movement. Mm-hmm. The need for unions to be calling officially for a general strike or a sympathy strike has been greatly diminished in terms of its efficacy. I mean, the reason why they said unions can't do that, I mean, the reason why that law was passed was because this allows the establishment the ability to hamstring the ability of unions to call for a general strike. Yep. There are no other mechanisms in which to call for a general strike, right, but for the organizational structure of unions. And we may be seeing a new one arising, which I think is going to have really interesting implications.
Yep. Yep.
But Chris Hayes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam. It's always a pleasure. We'll talk soon. We'll have you on the show soon.
I appreciate that. And based upon your fear of a global economic crisis, I am going right to goldline.com right now.
Yeah. Oh, that's right, Goldline. You're just reminding me of a story that I meant to bring up in our editorial meeting. I totally forgot.
Well, there you go. Anytime. Awesome. I can be of help.
Yeah.
Look
so
this
great
weekend for that Goldline story, folks, on Up with Chris.
That's right. And we're going to have, let me tease, okay, this weekend we're going to have Peter Singer, the acclaimed moral philosopher, on the panel, which is going to be really fun.
Excellent. Well, I'm reading 5,000 Years of Debt based on...
Isn't that good?
It's great. It's
yeah,
great.
It's really great.
All right.
All right, man.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Talk to you, Sam.
All right. We're going to take a break, folks. When we come back, so many stories. So many stories. I honestly don't know where to begin. And I got to say, after that Chris Hayes interview, I may have to go out and buy a pack of cigarettes. I just, what a pleasure. Check out his show, folks. Check out his show. We'll be right back after this. So it's being reported now that the Occupy Iowa movement has announced plans to bring its protests to the 2012 campaign trail. Remember, the Iowa caucuses start on January 3rd. The plan has been dubbed First in the Nation Caucus Occupation. The idea, apparently, is that people coming to Iowa, occupying every presidential candidate's office, shutting them down until they start talking real turkey about what's going on in this country, where the 99% of people who are not benefiting at the expense of 1% who are getting away with murder, said Frank Cordaro, one of the organizers. The plan is to target offices for Republican candidates and President Barack Obama's campaign offices in the state. Occupy Iowa has been around since early October. And so these protesters are going to shut down at least the campaign headquarters. They're not going to interfere with the caucuses themselves. They're going to shut down the campaign headquarters. Meanwhile, back in New York yesterday, there was a anti-stop and frisk protest, which was joined by Occupy Wall Streeters. 27 arrests. These people specifically got themselves arrested as a deliberate act of civil disobedience. I was mentioning this the other day, hundreds of thousands of annually cops stop people and frisk them in New York. And I can tell you, I live in Manhattan. I've never seen one. So if you are young and African-American and you live in one of the boroughs, this is your reality. This is your reality. Meanwhile, Occupy Wall Street, to the extent that we have seen at least some real world implications, and there are a few, you know, aside from the rhetoric that we're seeing in the change in narrative, which I guess are real world implications, and the pressure, those who would encourage the super committee to cut Social Security and Medicare, they must be feeling this pushback. They must be feeling it, because you know that if a bank, and not just the other day we reported that a group of banks had decided not to follow Bank of America's lead with their $5 debit card fee. Well, Bank of America yesterday announced that it's nixing its plans to charge $5 a month for purchases with debit cards. They're going to have to find some other way to insert stealth fees for its users. And, of course, over this weekend, Bank Transfer Day, move your money, move our money, all different ways of doing the same thing. Get your money out of these banks just to punish them, just to show the power of the movement. David Day and the anger over the proposed fees combined with the protests have led several companion movements such as National Bank Transfer Day. He speculates the protests have revitalized a citizens' movement to take money out of the large Wall Street banks and put it into community banks or credit unions. A Bank of America official told Greg Sargent there was no direct correlation between the protests and the decision, but the official acknowledged that the atmosphere had been changed in a palpable way by the protests and by the media coverage of them. So good for Occupy Wall Street. Meanwhile, Jewish American leaders have denounced attempts to smear the Occupy Wall Street movement as anti-Semitic. They put out a statement, "We are publicly engaged American Jews who support both Israel and the ideas behind Occupy Wall Street and who also strongly oppose right-wing attempts to smear that movement with false charges of anti-Semitism. It's an old, discredited tactic. Find a couple of unrepresentative people in a large movement, then conflate the oddity with the cause. One black swan means all swans are black." You all remember, longtime listeners of this version of the Majority Report will remember me referring to Matthew Lawyer's friend, who claims to be an independent, but the other day literally wrote me an email telling me to read Ann Coulter's book as a reference point. Has been writing these, sending these email blasts from the right-wing blogosphere about how anti-Semitic Occupy Wall Street is. And I said, there are two clips that get played over and over again. The one by that guy, Lotion Man, who is a half-Jewish, crazy performance artist, who has said already in another subsequent video that he was just messing with some old man. But it's clearly not a representative of Occupy Wall Street in any fashion. And then this other guy who is purported to be semi-crazed, who's holding up a sign that says, you know, different signs about Zionist bankers and whatnot. The flip side says, Jesus loves you. And he refers to himself as Jesus. Those are the only two videos you will see. But they get recycled over and over again. I pointed this out to Matthew Lawyer's friend. And he said, no, there are tons. Just check out YouTube. The functional equivalent of saying there are a lot of anti-Semites. Just view the world. Unbelievable. And in the better half of the show, I will discuss the video done by the Breitbart agent, Lee Stranahan. And by agent, I mean representative of. But we need to talk about this. I went on to Kudlow's show last night. Had the opportunity to sit across from Armstrong Williams, who I don't know that I've ever met in person, but I certainly spent a little time when I was on Air America discussing, because he was on the morning local show. Yeah, just at one, you know, episode number 5,653 where I screwed myself. But, you know, I couldn't help it. Armstrong Williams had been paid by the Bush administration to basically promote some of their policies under the guise of being an impartial commentator. Or not impartial, but a non-bot commentator. I expressed my displeasure with him being in the morning show that preceded mine on the local affiliate in New York. And they bumped me off the station for a day. Got me in some hot water. What are you going to do? I got an attitude problem. It's not the first time I've been told about it. Anyways, I sat across from him. He was perfectly fine. Then some guy, I think, from the National Review Online. I don't truck in those waters. Or I guess sail in those waters. So I'm not fully aware of it. But Herman Cain. I don't know which is more damning. The FEC violations that he clearly was involved in Wisconsin. The fact that the attorney, Herman Cain, has been accused. Well, let me put it this way. It was reported that Herman Cain, as he was head of a of the restaurant lobbyist group back in the, I guess it was the late 90s. He was head of the National Restaurant Association. It was reported that he had paid out to two different women through the association settlements to make them go away with their grievances of sexual harassment by him. When the story first broke, apparently he was given 10 days notice that the story was going to break, never really responded to the reporters in any sufficient way. When the story broke, in the morning, he didn't remember it. In the afternoon, he remembered it. He said it was, well, I didn't say that it was, you know, there's a difference between a settlement and an agreement. And we had an agreement, not a settlement. I guess his version of the definition of is. But be that as it may, he's been out talking about the people who filed these complaints and were paid off by his group. And now the lawyer for the one of the women who accused Herman Cain of sexual harassment and received a settlement in return for a non-disclosure form said his client may get a chance to speak publicly about the allegations because the GOP presidential candidate violated the confidentiality agreement between the two. There was more than one incident that my client received sexual harassment, the lawyer said. She would like to speak out for the record only because Mr. Cain has stated that he didn't sexually harass anyone, that there wasn't any substance to the allegations, and basically made it look like she was some type of frivolous claimant looking for money. She received a year's worth of salary, $35,000. The lawyer said Cain violated that agreement on Fox News on Monday when he said that he'd been told the accuser's performance in the workplace was, quote, not up to par. Par, apparently, meaning she wouldn't put out for me. I think she's upset about his statements and would like the record to be balanced and clear, said Bennett. So it remains to be seen if the National Restaurant Association will release her from the confidentiality agreement. Understand that it is a Republican primary candidate who leaked this story. You've got Karl Rove out there saying that all information should be released. You had Rick Santorum's campaign come out very early and say that Cain should come clean. I have speculated that it's either, you know, Perry trying to get back into the race, Santorum trying to up his chances of becoming a VP nominee. Who knows? But I said on Kudlow last night, and I'll say it again here, and I've said it before, Herman Cain is not really running for president. Or at least he wasn't in the beginning. He has no ground game in any of the important primary states. He was looking to sell books, and then all of a sudden, the nut jobs in the Republican electoral base decided he was their favorite guy because he came up with a plan that only had three numbers in it, 999. And it sounded like a plan for the country's economy that could fit on one page. And as Ann Coulter says, our black guys are better than theirs. But this is a guy who knows absolutely nothing about anything. You want the proof? Listen to Herman Cain on PBS. Now, I don't know if we have grade schoolers or people in junior high, let's say, who listen to this program. I imagine we have a couple. But I want to know if a junior high school student would know what was wrong with what Herman Cain is saying here.
China, do you view China as a potential military threat to the United States?
I do view China as a potential military threat to the United
States.
And
stop. Could you do?
Now, perhaps if you're remaking Red Dawn, you view China as a potential military threat to the United States. Does anyone actually think that China is going to invade America? I didn't think so.
It was president to head that off.
My China strategy is quite simply outgrow China. It gets back to economics. China has a $6 trillion economy, and they're growing at approximately 10%. We have a $14 trillion economy, much bigger, but we're growing at an anemic 1.5, 1.6%. When we get our economy growing back at the rate of 5 or 6% that it has the ability to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, the idea that we are within any time period over the next 10 years going to just get our economy to grow at 5 or 6% per year. There's only one way that's going to happen, and it involves a harp and a unicorn. Or you could substitute a harp and perhaps a fairy. Or a harp and a really good magic wand. But that aside, here comes the real insanity.
We will outgrow China. And secondly, we already have superiority in terms of our military capability, and I plan to get away from making cutting our defense a priority and make investing in our military capability a priority, going back to my statement, peace through strength and clarity. So, yes, they're a military threat. They've indicated that they're trying to develop nuclear capability and they want to develop more aircraft carriers like we have. So, yes, we have to consider them a military threat.
Well, wait, what? China is indicated that they're trying to develop a nuclear capability? Holy cow. One has to wonder if Herman Cain's advisors have been in a dunked in amber for 40 years. The Chinese tested their first nuclear weapon in 1964. I'll tell you what happened. Herman Cain never thought that he would ever be asked any question other than what was it like to be a pizza salesman? And now he's faced with a dilemma of, oh my God, I know nothing about most things. And apparently people want you to know something about some things if you're going to be president. Herman Cain, the only thing that's going to save you is the utter ignorance of the people that you're hoping will vote for you in the GOP primary. My understanding is that Rasmussen has Cain up 10 percentage points since saying those words and being accused of sexual harassment. So congratulations, Republican primary voters. I cannot tell you how much I hope that you vote for Herman Cain. Can we get one of these, like, that's a smile right there. Should we end it with the Herman Cain song?
I'll give you one of these, yeah.
Okay.
Herman Cain knows how
All right. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it is time to go to the better half of the program, during which time you may call me at the following number, 646-257-3920. Ladies and gentlemen, if you can become a member of the Majority Report, please do. We're coming up on our year anniversary. I am way, way, way behind on projections of members. We got to figure out a way of celebrating.
We do.
All right. I am way behind on members. I could really use your help, folks. In the member show, I'll talk about a story, which I always love hearing that someone I have spoken about on this program has heard that I was speaking about them. Because it means that not only are we informing and hopefully occasionally entertaining you, but we're also affecting the behavior of, in some small measure, those who are subjects on this program. And that's a good thing. It's very gratifying. You people provide the platform and support the message, and it gets out there. Very encouraging. But please become a member if you can. And don't forget, you can support the show in many other ways. I'm not even going to talk about it today. I just don't feel like it. It's hump day. A little bit of house cleaning tomorrow. We're doing a tech day. We'll have a new interview for you. Zach Carter on the trade bill that was passed a couple of weeks ago. Pretty depressing. But also a good interview. So what are you going to do? All right. See you on the better half of the program.